From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Russian foreign minister speaks out about its troops near Ukraine. Kerry says Israeli and Palestinian leaders have to lead on peace talks. A closer look at the use of explosive weapons in Syria.
People are just acknowledging the impact on civilians with barely a shrug.
And millions face potential famine in South Sudan. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says troops near the Ukrainian border will return to their permanent bases as soon as they finish military exercises. Ukrainian officials have said as many as 100,000 Russian soldiers along its eastern and southern borders are poised to invade. NATO's top commander, General Philip Breedlove, said Wednesday the Russian force is ready to go and could take over large parts of Ukraine in as little as 3 days. Foreign Minister Lavrov today called on the West and Ukraine to de-escalate the rhetoric, which he says is becoming unreasonable. Meanwhile, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde said Wednesday that as the world struggles to emerge from the 2008 financial crisis, economies are under threat from tensions involving Ukraine and Russia's annexation of Crimea.
Our hope for the program for Ukraine to work, and I'm looking, you know, with my narrow lenses of economic and financial stability, is that geopolitical tensions go away, come down, so that that country and its people can actually recover.
Return to the Soviet Union has been the buzz phrase for an emboldened Russia under President Vladimir Putin since the start of the Crimean crisis. VOA's Michael Eccles in Moscow has this look at the issue.
History professor Andrei Zubov was fired from the Moscow State Institute for Foreign Relations for a newspaper article comparing Russian President Vladimir Putin's actions in Ukraine to Adolf Hitler's Anschluss. He gave two reasons for writing it. Zubov said he wanted to see how far Russia had come from the Soviet era. He wrote the article as a message and an experiment. Zubov's dismissal and the recent crackdown on press independence, TV Rain, and Lenta.ru demonstrates tightening control over dissent, reminiscent of Soviet times. But according to Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Center, there are crucial differences with contemporary Russia, especially lack of ideology.
Socialist, communist, however you call it, but there was a clear set of ideas, of formula, of tenets that was radically different from those of the West.
The West, however, remains the primary antagonist. The Russian parliament is pushing criminal legislation to mandate the disclosure of dual citizenship. Mr. Putin had a few comments.
Мы вполне должны и имеем право знать.
He said Russians have the right to know who's living in their country and what they're up to, and that dual citizens must be kept track of. Zubov has a simple explanation for the government's reliance on old paradigms. The middle and older generations are used to thinking in the Soviet fashion and are not accustomed to new ideas, he said. Aimed primarily at Ukrainian-Russian dual citizens, the Carnegie Center's Lipman additionally sees this as a turn away from the international Soviet identity.
The developments in the Crimea are pushing him and Russia in general towards something that is that looks increasingly nativist.
A move toward ethnic nationalist policy could be dangerous for a Russia just as diverse as its predecessor. Meanwhile, old methods remain at the ready for new ideas in development. Michael Eccles, Voice of America, Moscow, Russia.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he is reaching out in separate telephone calls to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas after both sides broke parts of an agreement on talks toward a two-state solution. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from Algiers, where Kerry discussed prospects for Mideast peace with the Algerian foreign minister.
Secretary Kerry says U.S. negotiators met with Israeli and Palestinian officials in overnight talks that lasted until 4 in the morning in an effort to move the peace process forward.
I think it is a critical moment, obviously. The dialogue remains open. There was progress made in narrowing some of the questions that have arisen as a result of the events of the last few days, but there's still a gap, and that gap will have to be closed, and closed fairly soon.
The events of the past few days have been the biggest challenges to 8 months of peace talks. They include the Israeli cabinet failing to approve the release of a group of Palestinian prisoners and Palestinian officials voting to join 15 international organizations that would draw them closer to enhanced UN recognition. Kerry says Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas both understand what the choices are and what the stakes are, as well as their own limits and dynamics. He says the fight here is not over the fundamental substance of a final status agreement on a two-state solution, but rather over the process to get there.
It would be a tragedy for both of them, we would say, for them to lose the opportunity to get to those real issues that are the differences of a final status agreement. A fight over process, how to get into a negotiation, should not stop you from getting into that negotiation. And so I hope that they will consider that very, very carefully.
Kerry says the United States will continue to do everything in its power to try to bring them together, to find the place of reasonableness, to encourage them to compromise and show them ways in which they might do so. But in the end, they're the ones who have to say yes.
You can facilitate, you can push, you can nudge, but the parties themselves have to make fundamental decisions and compromises. The leaders have to lead, and they have to be able to see a moment when it's there.
Each side is accusing the other of violating agreements guiding these U.S.-led talks that are scheduled to stop at the end of this month. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Algiers.
The Syrian conflict has claimed more than 100,000 lives, forced millions of people to leave their homes, and reduced cities to rubble, according to Action on Armed Violence. AOAV works to reduce and hopefully prevent the impact of conflicts around the world. And lately, they have been taking a closer look at Syria, where they report explosive weapons have shaped the dynamics of the fighting. Robert Perkins is their senior weapons researcher.
It's 3 years pretty much to the week that the conflict first started. In 2011, there was a series of protests, which the Syrian government responded to with the actual use of explosive weapons quite early on, which was unusual. It's not very common for a government to deploy such heavy weapons that aren't really used for domestic law enforcement among its own people. And that rapidly escalated into a series of increasingly violent face-offs and standoffs. And everybody knows the story of how the conflict developed over the next 2 years. The use of explosive weapons steadily escalated. And in February 2012, we saw the first situation where they were used in a wholesale sense in a populated area in the city of Homs, when there was steady bombardment throughout February 2012, and it killed more than 640 civilians. And that was a turning point from which we haven't really looked back. And 3 years down the line, this conflict has continued to develop at the cost of more than 100,000 lives, many of whom are civilians.
Are we seeing the use of these weapons on both sides now?
Oh, very much so, yes. It's by no means just the regime who are using explosive weapons and heavy explosive weapons at that. At first, it wasn't the case, but for well over a year, that's definitely been the case that all parties are using explosive weapons.
What is exactly an explosive weapon? If you could describe some of them for us.
Oh, absolutely. It's a good question because it's not a category of weapons that is easy to understand first off, but they're anything that affects an area with blast and fragmentation effects. So it includes things like airdrop bombs and the barrel bombs that we've been seeing recently are an example of those. It includes things like rockets, mortars, and artillery shells. And it also includes the improvised bomb, which has caused a wide number of casualties in Syria and elsewhere. All of these weapons share the same central characteristic of not being able to limit their effects to one single person, which is why they've been such a problem and why they've been the driver of the crisis in Syria.
How would you compare this problem in Syria to other conflicts in the world?
The use of explosive weapons in Syria is much more intensive than anywhere else in the world at the moment. Although we've seen examples in recent years, you know, 2006 in the Gaza Strip and 2008 in Sri Lanka, for example, also in Afghanistan and Iraq, they're widely used. My organization, Action on Armed Violence, records casualties from explosive weapons around the world from English language media sources. And last year, and also in 2012, both years, We recorded a casualty from an explosive weapon in 58 different countries. So they're widely used weapons, but in Syria, it's more intense than anywhere else in the world, just by our data alone. And as an indication of that, 89% of the casualties that we've recorded from explosive weapons in Syria were civilians, unarmed people, innocent people. That has been dramatically much, much higher than the rest of the world, even though it's high there too. In the rest of the world, not including Syria, that percentage drops to 75%. So that's just kind of one example of how significant the use is there.
Aren't these weapons very expensive?
Yeah, I suppose they are. Syria had an extremely well-stocked arsenal of these weapons before the conflict started. They had one of the biggest stockpiles of weapons and of platforms to use them in the Middle East and in North Africa, basically anywhere in the world, actually. And they've been built up over a long period of time. What's important to note is that a lot of these weapons are not new, flash, smart weapons. They are weapons that date back to the 60s and 70s in many cases, and they were mostly bought from the Soviet Union. So they've been built up over a very long period of time. And they're being used, as I said earlier, by both the regime and the opposition. A lot of the weapons that the opposition are sourcing are coming directly from the regime's stockpiles, either stockpiles that have been raided or weapons that have been seized during the course of combat. And they're also being made by rebels and opposition forces themselves. So both sides are now using makeshift DIY weapons to supplement their existing arsenals.
Well, what can we learn? What lessons can we learn from this situation in Syria?
There's a lot that can be learned, and there's a lot that needs to be done both in Syria and elsewhere. And we need to do everything we can to prevent another situation like this emerging. My organization is part of something called the International Network on Explosive Weapons. And we believe that it's of paramount importance that states begin to challenge and explore their own practices around the use of these weapons. It's for far, far too long, it's been just accepted as part of the norm that explosive weapons, weapons that affect an area, can be used in places where civilians are gathered, and that the casualties that result from that are simply unfortunate collateral damage. And this has been seen in Syria just 3 years down the line. People approach this conflict with a sense of great fatigue, even here where we are never, it's never unshocking what's happening in Syria. But even here, people are just acknowledging the impact on civilians with barely a shrug. And that has to stop. We're not calling for a ban on these weapons because we recognize that will probably never happen. But we are calling for states to take on their own practices and raise the threshold of acceptability around their use in places where civilians can be affected.
Robert Perkins, the senior weapons researcher with Action on Armed Violence and author of the report, Syria, 3 years in, a country torn apart by explosive violence. The United Nations warns millions of people in South Sudan are facing a potential famine because of a huge funding shortfall. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva. A senior UN official says more than $230 million is needed in the next 2 months to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe.
About 1 million South Sudanese have been forced to flee their homes during the past 100 days. More than 800,000 are internally displaced within South Sudan. The rest are refugees in neighboring countries. The UN humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, says this tragedy will likely be compounded by hundreds of thousands leaving the country this year. He notes entire cities have been destroyed since the conflict between government and opposition forces erupted in mid-December. He says markets have collapsed and trade has virtually stopped with Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya. He says people are facing destitution.
We've got 3.7 million people who are already at severe risk of starvation. And we are, in the month of April and May, supposed to be celebrating the planting season. This is when it starts to rain and when people cultivate their fields, they tend to their cattle, their sheep and their goats, but they can't because it's unsafe. They can't move to their fields with the sort of freedom that is required.
Lanzer is telling international donors and government officials that millions of South Sudanese need help to survive. But he also says these people must be given the opportunity to help themselves. He says money is needed now to make sure people have food in their stomachs so they have the energy to till the land. He tells VOA it is critical that farmers be given the seeds and tools they need to start planting their crops today.
If we were to miss the planting season, there will be a catastrophic decline in food security, because what will strike that country, and it will hit about 7 million people, will be more grave than anything that continent has seen since the mid-1980s. So we're trying to prevent that. And if that were to happen, it's going to cost people a whole lot more. So invest now or pay later.
Lanzer says an immediate injection of $232 million would enable agencies to pre-position relief supplies before the rainy season, which will render most of the country inaccessible by road. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
2 decades have passed since hundreds of thousands of people were killed in the Rwanda genocide, and Western powers were accused of standing by and allowing it to happen. As VOA's Kent Klein reports, experts say there are lessons to be learned on how to prevent such tragedies in the future.
The world was shocked when an estimated 800,000 Rwandans were massacred in about 100 days, starting April 7, 1994. Members of the ethnic Hutu majority killed about 70% of the minority Tutsis living in Rwanda and many moderate Hutus. U.S. President Bill Clinton was criticized at home and abroad for doing nothing to stop the slaughter. 4 years later, he visited Rwanda and apologized for his inaction.
We did not act quickly enough after the killing began. But all over the world, there were people like me sitting in offices day after day after day who did not fully appreciate the depth and the speed with which you were being engulfed by this unimaginable terror.
Despite the vow of never again, the catastrophe in Rwanda did not bring the end of widespread violence against civilians. Genocide in Sudan's Darfur region and sectarian violence in the Central African Republic are among the acts of mass brutality since then that have left millions dead or homeless. In the Syrian civil war, at least 150,000 people are believed to have been killed, and another U.S. president has been accused of inaction. Amnesty International's Adote Akwe says opposition from Russia in the United Nations Security Council is blocking White House efforts to stop the violence in Syria.
The international community has to end the crisis in Syria somehow, and the administration has been consistent in trying to do that, but it's not been able to actually achieve the results that we all want to see.
Veteran U.S. diplomat Johnny Carson, now a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute for Peace, says the Rwanda genocide taught the world it has to move quickly.
Act swiftly and to muster the resources of the international community to condemn and engage as quickly as possible when we see an atrocity about to occur.
Ambassador Carson says the lessons of Rwanda and other massacres led President Barack Obama to establish an Atrocities Prevention Board,
which is an interagency group that gets together once a month under the direction of the National Security Council to review situations around the world that may be likely to turn into atrocities or mass violence.
Akwe says the board is a major step forward, but efforts to prevent atrocities must start sooner.
It would be better and probably more economical to try to challenge intolerance and hate propaganda earlier on, before all of the actors are in place, when things are actually beginning to threaten people.
Akwe says the best way to prevent genocide is to show that the world is watching and will not tolerate it. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Deserts are generally known as large expanses of land. With such dry weather, they're hostile to life. Some deserts are actually lush, with plants and animals that thrive in dry conditions. One of the world's most intriguing is the Sonoran Desert, which spans the southwestern U.S. and northwestern Mexico. From Tucson, Arizona, Shelley Schlender takes us there.
As drivers speed down the highways across the vast Sonoran Desert, the only life they see often seems to be giant saguaro cacti, standing alone and silent as sentinels. But at the Sonora Desert Museum, life is everywhere, including on this blustery, scrub-covered bluff, where a museum volunteer uses a loudspeaker to tell a large crowd about one of the most extraordinary birds of prey exhibitions in the U.S. A volunteer trainer raises his arm to send a raptor into the air.
This is a beautiful female red-tailed hawk.
The hawk swoops so close, her wings nearly brush people's heads. To bring her back to his leather-gloved hand, the trainer holds up a strip of meat. Up next, a peregrine falcon. As a grand finale, the trainers give wing to an entire family of russet-feathered Harris hawks. The hawks soar across the valley, then perch on tall saguaro cacti. When their trainers call them in, they suddenly go off script. They dive into the sagebrush and make a kill.
This is a good example of a group hunt. They were all sitting here.
More tranquil moments await visitors who stroll the museum's 3 kilometers of outdoor paths, past yellow desert daisies, pink globe mallow, grasses with blue blossoms, prickly cactus, and 60,000 other plants. All have evolved to thrive throughout the Sonoran Desert on hardly any precipitation. A good example, says museum horticulturalist John Weens, is this desert ironwood tree.
It can go through incredible droughts and die back clear to the ground and resprout new trunks from the ground time and time again.
He says there's a reason this world-class zoo is also a botanical garden.
We have a lot of different plants from our region here with interpretation to let them know that animals don't stand alone in nature and neither do plants. It's all interrelated, interlinked.
Interlinked in another desert ecosystem, a green Arizona parrot perches on desert scrub oak. It's not far from a steep cliff with a pond at the bottom and a cave far away at the top. In that cave is a man-sized mountain lion.
Are there mountain lions in this area?
There are tons of them.
Really?
Continuing on the path, visitors reach the backside of that cave where they discover not a cave wall, but a picture window, behind which is the mountain lion watching them.
Skylar, isn't he cute? Don't you want a kitty like that?
A mother and her preschool son lean forward.
He's a big little girl.
He's a cutie, huh? But you don't ever pet those if you see him in your backyard.
Other exhibits let visitors get up close to more than 200 native desert animals that slither, creep, and fly.
His tail, it makes rattles. And you don't go near that sound because he's warning you that you're getting too close and he'll bite you. He's got fangs in his mouth. You see him?
He has a tongue too.
Yeah, he's got a tongue. A long tongue.
Spider, 8 legs.
So this is the desert blonde spider.
On the nest, there's a hummingbird right there on the nest. He's looking at me.
The museum's marketing director, Rosemary Prodzik, says these native animals in their natural settings are popular.
We're ranked the number 9 museum in the world. And that's based on our ratings on TripAdvisor by people who visit. So it's people like you and me who come and experience it and realize that this place is really a gem.
The museum also leads major conservation efforts throughout the Sonoran Desert region, all part of fulfilling its mission to inspire people to live in harmony with the natural world. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender near Tucson, Arizona.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.